The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That is GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. This edition of Time Magazine is dated February 24, 2025. As usual, the front cover features a bright red border with a narrow white inner border. Time, in large block capital letters, is in a white, or rather a grayish off-white against a gray background. Four young people, two males, two females, are featured on the cover because it says, "Our cancer mystery, what is now striking us so young?" I will turn then to the text of this Time Magazine edition. Security, TikTok, All Over Again by Andrew R. Chow. The fast-rising Chinese AI lab DeepSeek, that's one word, DeepSeek, is sparking U.S. national security concerns over fears that its AI models, like R1, could be used by the Chinese government to spy on American civilians, learn proprietary secrets, and wage influence campaigns. Congress, the U.S. Navy, and NASA all banned internal use of DeepSeek's models. The Senate is considering a bill similar to the TikTok ban that would restrict access to Chinese-created AI. One major concern centers on users' data. DeepSeek's privacy policy states it collects IP addresses, keystroke patterns, other data from users, and stores personal information on Chinese servers. Generative AI tools are often used in personal or high-stakes tasks to seek health advice, manage finances, help with company strategies. That kind of data may now be stored in a country with few data rights laws and little transparency with regard to how that data might be viewed or used, including potentially by the government. Some American leaders worry DeepSeek could be used to promote Chinese political aims. Most AI models apply censorship in certain key ways or display biases based on the data they are trained upon. Users have found DeepSeek's R1 refuses to answer questions about the 1989 massacre at Tiananmen Square and asserts Taiwan is a part of China. Cybersecurity experts also worry DeepSeek could be wielded in mass malware, injections, or other kinds of cyber attacks. AI industry leaders and politicians have responded, calling for restrictions on Chinese AI tech and increased investment into the American AI sector. U.S. Congress members have floated stronger export controls on technologies underpinning DeepSeek's AI infrastructure. President Trump called DeepSeek a wake-up call that we need to be laser-focused on competing to win. What? It doesn't say. That new urgency leads privacy experts and AI ethicists to worry. The panic over DeepSeek's rise might lead to the deregulation of the U.S. AI industry at a time when the need for industry safeguards is becoming increasingly apparent. There are completely valid privacy and data security concerns with DeepSeek, says Callie Schrader, the AI and human rights lead at the Electronic Privacy Information Center. But all of those are present in the U.S. AI products, too. Schrader urges restraint when using models like DeepSeek. If you have concerns about the origin of a company, she says, be very, very careful about what you reveal about yourself and others in these systems. Next, from the brief, Time 2030, Innovation, Building for Disaster Resilience by Natalie Donbach, or Donbach. Photo here, it's not real large, it's in color. A lot of gray and tan with a pale blue sky, and let's see, the caption says, the fire-resistant home Greg Chasen designed in January. Okay, well, this house appears to be standing intact on its suburban or city lot, whereas an automobile and a house on either side, in other words, two houses beside it, have been decimated by fire. January 7th. Architect Greg Chasen rushed to his childhood home in Pacific Palisades, a well-off Los Angeles neighborhood tucked between the mountains and the Pacific Ocean, to remove any flammables and turn on the sprinklers. You could hear exploding propane tanks and see the flames reflected in the smoke. I was sure that fire was going to tear through overnight, he says. At some point, there was nothing left to do but go home and wait. At dawn the next day, Chasen jumped on his bike to inspect the damage, bracing for the worst. While just a few degrees of wind direction had saved his parents' home from the flames, other streets were not as lucky. Next, he went to check on a house he'd finished building for a friend only 6 months earlier. As he got closer, the magnitude of the destruction hit him. Almost the entire neighborhood was gone. More houses were going up in flames. Everything had this acrid smell of burning plastic, he says. But there it was, the newly built two-story house, remarkably untouched. While 120 houses farther down the street had been transformed into piles of ashes, Chasen's fire-resistant design had withstood the heat from the flames. The wildfires that ripped through L.A. in January claimed the lives of 29 people and destroyed more than 16,000 structures. These types of disasters are only set to become more frequent and intense as climate change drives warmer and drier conditions. According to NASA, parts of the western U.S., Mexico, Brazil, and East Africa now have fire seasons that last more than a month longer than they did 35 years ago. And the UN estimates the number of wildfires globally will increase by 50% by the end of the century. Last year marked the first year global temperatures surpassed 1.5 degrees centigrade of warming compared with pre-industrial levels. The limit meant to avert the worst impacts and preserve a livable planet outlined in the Paris Agreement, which President Trump took swift steps to withdraw from only hours into his second term. In response, architects like Chasen are embracing disaster-resilient designs. The Palisades house, which took 6 years to complete, incorporated defensible space, a border area from which anything flammable, like dead plants and wooden furniture, is removed. The landscaping was also made fire-resilient with gravel and low plants rather than tall trees that can spread flames to adjacent structures. In 2020, California lawmakers passed a law making defensible space mandatory in high-risk areas. but the law was never implemented and regulations still have not been written. This could have very much helped the community, says Chasen. The house was also tightly sealed, including with double-paned windows. When a neighbor's car exploded and broke the outer window pane, the interior layer stayed intact, keeping the fire out. While most attic designs count on vents to prevent condensation, Chasen's did not. Vents are the easiest way for embers, which California officials and researchers say are responsible for 90% of structures destroyed by wildfire, to get in. As Angelenos prepare to rebuild, we have to look not only at individual homes, but at the community as a whole element, says Michelle Barbato, a professor in civil and environmental engineering at the University of California, Davis. It is similar to the theory of herd immunity under vaccination. If you have enough homes that are protected, they'll be able to protect others. But a critical mass of burning homes will compromise the entire community by spreading the fire from one building to the next, Barbato explains. Another factor is that people are increasingly moving into areas at high risk of natural disasters, particularly in the face of rising property prices. Some people like to live near the forest, but some have to live there because it's the only place they can afford, says Barbato. Understanding past disasters in a specific location used to help prepare for future ones, but with climate change, it's a moving target, says Jay Raskin, a retired architect who helped create the Oregon Resilience Plan, aimed at preparing for a Cascadia Subduction Zone earthquake and tsunami. Architects in earthquake zones are increasingly using base isolation, which involves putting buildings on huge flexible pads that can reduce violent shaking by up to 75%. It is much more effective than trying to build really stout and strong, says Raskin. Buildings like the new Oregon State Treasury are designed to withstand not only earthquakes, but also other hazards, such as floods, wildfires, even civil unrest. Following a disaster, it is crucial to ensure that public institutions and emergency services can continue to function, says Raskin. On the other side of the Pacific Ocean, Japanese architects have long grappled with how to design for multiple hazards. While heavy houses are better for earthquakes, lighter ones are better for flooding, says Taku Hibino, CEO of Hibino Sekei, an architecture firm specializing in care facilities for children and other vulnerable groups. We cannot expect kids and elderly people to be able to run away when a disaster happens, so we try to make the architecture safe enough so that they don't need to go outside to evacuate. Hibino's firm rebuilt a kindergarten in Fukushima following the disastrous 2011 earthquake that claimed over 18,000 lives and caused the meltdown of three nuclear power reactors. The kindergarten, which was destroyed, had to be rebuilt quickly, with not only a future earthquake, but also radiation in mind. At the time, children could not play outside, so we had to design it in a way that would allow the kids to play indoors, says Hibino. The design incorporated a 50-meter-wide corridor that allows the kids to run around, as well as an indoor pool and a large sandbox. Sometimes overly disaster-proof buildings become too dull and lifeless. That's where architects come into play with our creativity. In low-lying Bangladesh, 60% of the population is at high risk of floods, and climate change is making extreme rainfall even more common. Rural communities in the north are increasingly embracing living with floods, which also provide important nutrients to the soil. We are seeing a shift to building houses with lighter materials that can easily be dismantled and moved during floods, says Apoorva Kumar Poddar, a professor in architecture at BUET University in Dhaka. Building expensive and super-fortified structures is not a feasible solution for low-income communities and is difficult to scale up. While no single approach is perfect, solutions range from floating houses to homes built on stilts. Kumar believes working closely with local communities to leverage their traditional knowledge while improving the sustainability of materials is key for boosting resilience. While concrete is fire resistant and widely available, it is responsible for 8% of planet warming carbon dioxide emissions. Alternatives like cross-laminated timber, made by gluing together layers of wooden panels at right angles, are quickly gaining popularity and can resist both fire and earthquakes well, says Raskin. At UC Davis, Barbato and his team have spent 15 years developing fire-resistant materials, including earth blocks made by mixing mud with a small amount of chemical stabilizer like lime or cement. They look like huge Lego blocks made with soil and with a spring inside to keep them all attached, he says, adding the material has a very high resistance to hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, and wildfires. For now, a lot of red tape makes it difficult to scale up the material's use, and getting a permit is a lengthy and expensive process. But with enough research, Barbato believes the technology can halve construction labor costs compared with ordinary masonry, reducing the cost of building resilient homes. It is about building homes that people feel safe leaving during an evacuation order, knowing their house will still be standing when they come back, he says. While those in Pacific Palisades are still processing and grieving what was lost in the wildfires, it is also important for homeowners to consider their responsibility and how they can build better going forward, says Chasen. If you need to build a smaller, more modest house, do it. From the business pages, the Paw Patrol Principle, how a toy company built a children's television juggernaut. Long before he started watching TV, people started giving my son stuff, decorated with cute cartoon puppies, dressed in distinctive outfits. There was a Dalmatian dressed as a fireman, a bulldog construction worker, a German Shepherd police officer. I could not figure out why these brightly colored dogs seemed to be on roughly half the gear in our house, from shirts and hats to umbrellas and fire trucks. What I learned was that the puppies were characters in a TV show called Paw Patrol, which is about the adventures of a 10-year-old boy named Ryder, R-Y-D-E-R, and a crew of puppies who help people. The show is a children's entertainment juggernaut, Paw Patrol, which airs on Nickelodeon and is available to stream on YouTube, Paramount Plus, and other platforms, has been the third most in-demand children's TV series worldwide since at least 2020, beating out shows like Cocomelon, Bluey, Peppa Pig, according to Parrot Analytics. In the U.S., only SpongeBob SquarePants and Sesame Street ranked higher. In 2021, Paramount premiered a Paw Patrol movie, one of the first films targeted at the preschool set, and it grossed $144 million worldwide. A sequel in 2023, raked in even more money, and a third is in the works. But where Paw Patrol, and that's two words, is really without peer is in the realm of children's merchandising. Go into a Walmart or a Target and you'll find Paw Patrol everywhere, on the diapers, the toothpaste, the Band-Aids, the cereal, and of course in the toy aisle. Paramount estimates there are around 100,000 different Paw Patrol products. It was the top preschool toy property in each of the past 2 years in the U.S., the U.K., Spain, the Netherlands, Italy, France, Canada, Belgium, and Australia, according to the market research company Circana. To date, Paw Patrol toys and other consumer products have racked up more than $15 billion in retail sales worldwide, according to Paramount, which owns Nickelodeon. Paw Patrol was created in 2010 by Spin Master, two words, a Canadian toy company. At the time, Spin Master was known for selling gadgets like juggling sticks and radio-controlled airplanes. It had almost no track record in television. And while it is not unprecedented for TV shows to be based on toys, in the 1980s, both G.I. Joe and My Little Pony followed this path. Spin Master's innovation was to create a TV show and a toy brand in tandem from the start, with both the toy making and entertainment sides influencing one another. Typically, entertainment leads the way, says Amanda Cioletti, vice president of content and strategy at License Global, a trade publication. But they came together from the very beginning and created a television series that was simultaneously rooted in product. It is now conventional for film studios to launch movies alongside merchandise. Just look at all the Wicked goods that have gone on sale since the movie's November 2024 opening. But when Paw Patrol premiered, it was unusual for TV shows to even have much advanced merchandise, let alone for writers to consider it as they created the show. Now, because of the show's success, more consumer product executives want a seat at the entertainment table, Cioletti says. They've created this successful way to build a franchise, says Cioletti, and now it's become a reputable model for other entertainment and toy companies. Spin Master's broadening this strategy. The company's growing its Hollywood presence so that it can greenlight more movies and franchises outside Paw Patrol and the toys that go with them. We love the art of storytelling and character creation, says Ronan Harari, co-founder and CEO of Spin Master, so we're going to expand our storytelling scope. Whether this is a good thing for children is a different matter. Paw Patrol is not particularly educational. It does not, for example, teach children specific letters or numbers like Sesame Street, or lessons about how to navigate difficult childhood situations like Daniel Tiger. Critics have questioned the show's negative portrayal of government. The two mayors in the show are incompetent and dubbed it copaganda for the way it glamorizes law enforcement. Then there's the question of whether parents want merchandising opportunities to shape the programming their kids watch. If it feels normal for writers to create a show that the marketing division then commercializes, a threshold has been passed when toy makers create a show for kids with one eye turned toward getting their parents to buy products. On a recent Wednesday, a 10-year-old boy named Jesse Gervasi stands in a recording booth in Toronto, a baseball cap pulled over his eyes and his hands tucked into the pocket of his hoodie. Gervasi, that's spelled G-E-R-V-A-S-I, who voices Marshall, the Dalmatian fire pup, is reading lines for an upcoming Paw Patrol episode that involves farming. The character's goofy and a little bit clumsy. In this episode, like many others, Marshall trips before giggling out a pun. Phew, didn't see that coming, Gervasi says. Editors in the booth tell him to emphasize the D to highlight the farming joke. Eventually, Gervasi gets it right and he moves on to the next line. Ryder needs us. It's a phrase repeated in every episode, a cue for the pups to rush to the Paw Patrol lookout to find out their mission. This is a typical plot for a show about the hijinks of puppies who occupy a world of inept adults and whose salvation is a precocious 10-year-old boy with a lot of dogs. Each episode follows a similar format. A human or fellow animal gets in trouble. Ryder calls the pups together. He selects which ones will best be able to help him on their mission, and they get into their vehicles and set out to rescue someone. Paw Patrol began with a marketer's insight about what draws children in and a recognition of Spin Master's limitations. Toy makers like Spin Master do not typically invent toys themselves. Instead, they scout ideas from inventors. Founded in 1994 by two recent college graduates, Spin Master had done well commercializing concepts like Earth Buddy, a potato-like head that grows grass for hair, and Air Hogs, which are remote-controlled airplanes. But 15 years ago, it was struggling to get into the lucrative business of making toys based on popular characters like Mickey Mouse. We eventually figured, if we cannot get a character license, let's create one of our own, says Harari. The company's first attempt in 2008 was Bakugan, a ball that transforms into different action figures. The toy spawned a TV show and became a billion-dollar business. But after about 4 years, sales slumped, and Spin Master laid off more than 300 employees. What kids liked most about Bakugan, that's B-A-K-U-G-A-N, was that it transformed from one thing into another. So, Spin Master decided to put out a call for ideas about toys that involved transformation, hoping to find one it could simultaneously develop into a TV show. The idea really was about controlling our own destiny, to be able to develop, create, and produce series, since we did not have a drawer full of brands like other companies, says Jennifer Dodge, who joined Spin Master in 2009 to launch its entertainment studio. A pitch from a toy creator named Keith Chapman fit the bill. Chapman's concept was about a boy named Robbie, who worked with a team of rescue pups to help people. Robbie was later changed to Ryder. The company got to work developing the story behind the pups, drawing on its own expertise with play patterns, essentially how kids entertain themselves, Harari says. Executives brought in both animators and toy designers who worked together to create characters and storylines. It really became an iterative process between toy designers and animation designers working together, Dodge said. At the time, Spin Master had about 900 employees, but its entertainment division consisted of only 4 people. Still, with Spin Master's input, the show evolved from a concept about rescue pups to one about pups whose backpacks transform into tools, a key facet of the toys it would sell. The toy designers helped determine what the pups in their vehicles and houses would look like and assisted in picking the different dog breeds and giving them personalities. Paw Patrol was a hit from the moment it aired in 2013, quickly becoming Nickelodeon's highest-rated preschool show. Spin Master was ready with toys that rolled out to market within a few months. The lookout, the dogs, their dog houses, the many bigger vehicles like cargo ships and airplanes that carry the pups to different locations. As the show grew in popularity, the company added an extensive products and experiences program. as Paramount puts it, that includes clothes, video games, live stage tours, theme park attractions, and toys. More than a decade since its debut, the show continues to be shaped by merchandising opportunities. Spin Master changes the theme of the episodes every few seasons. The pups become aqua pups who wear scuba gear, or medieval knights who wear armor, or super pups with superpowers, all changes that create new toys for parents to buy their eager children. It's like, how do you make a fire truck look different each time, Dodge says. How can it have features or do something innovative that we have never done before? All this merchandising can make the Paw Patrol universe feel inescapable to parents. We live and breathe Paw Patrol, says Andrea Jordan, a nurse from Richmond, Virginia, whose 3.5-year-old daughter is obsessed with the show. Jordan has spotted Paw Patrol logos adorning nap mats, bath toys, even once on a hospital cap. Though its ubiquity can be unnerving, Jordan says she's glad the show at least teaches children about the importance of kindness. Parents of young children may have been young kids themselves when this became possible. Until 1984, the Federal Communications Commission imposed time limits on how much advertising could air during children's programming. But that year, the FCC removed those limits at the urging of Ronald Reagan, who argued that such regulation limited free speech. This deregulation prompted toy manufacturers to become heavily involved in children's programming, sometimes offering broadcasters a cut of toy sales if they aired certain shows. In 1991, the FCC restored some time limits on advertising during children's programming, but toy companies and their products had become so intertwined with shows by then that the new regulations did not make much of a difference. Today, most children's TV shows are built around licensed characters who are also slapped on food products and clothes and made into toys. The problem with this is that children play less creatively with toys linked to media properties, says Susan Lynn, a psychologist and author of Who's Raising the Kids? When they play, for instance, with wooden blocks or anonymous dolls, Lynn notes, children may make up their own worlds and use their imaginations. When they play with Paw Patrol, branded gear, or SpongeBob SquarePants toys, they will likely just be recreating the storylines they saw on TV. Creative play is the foundation of learning, Lynn says. Stifling that creativity deprives them of what has forever been a part of healthy play. Still, it's hard to blame studios for using licensing to turn their creative properties into revenue streams. As more families eschew traditional networks and embrace content on platforms like YouTube, it can be harder for studios to come up with the cash needed to fund children's programming, says Nancy Jennings, a professor at the University of Cincinnati who studies media's impact on children. As a result, creators are trying to seek out other avenues like licensing and merchandising to make money. Paw Patrol succeeds at this in part because of its global appeal. The pups do not belong to any particular country or racial group, which makes it easy for any kid to identify with them. The cartoon has been translated into 32 languages. It's the number one linear program on Nick Jr. in 10 countries. All the characters are kind to one another, and the pups' jobs are familiar to children the world over whose first hero is a police officer or firefighter who they see doing work in their community, says Dodge, the Spin Master executive. Being inescapable and globally appealing is, of course, part of the company's strategy. Almost all kids like puppies, and thanks to Paw Patrol, they can wear them on their clothes and snack on their likenesses, even if they don't watch TV. There's one photograph here, about a fourth of a page. It's in brilliant color. I'll read the caption first. The pups with a fan at a 2023 event for Paw Patrol, The Mighty Movie, in East Rutherford, New Jersey. Four pups here. They're life-size, that is, they're the outfits, the costumes, are occupied by humans, undoubtedly, or they could be audio animatronics, but they look like small human-sized people to me within these costumes, and they're full costumes. They've got the pants, the vest, the tail, the gloves, the head, which is dog-looking, but pleasantly dog-looking. Some have long ears, some have pointy ears. Some are floppy ears. And then they have these little helmets on top of them. So one tan pup is wearing yellow and blue. The brown pup is wearing blue and silver. The yellowish pup is wearing pink and silver. And the Dalmatian, the white with black spots pup, is wearing red, gray, well, or maybe it's red and silver. We'll go with red and silver. And the kid who's being hugged by the brown pup in the blue and silver outfit is, oh gosh, maybe anywhere between 6 and 10, I would say. And he looks very happy to be squeezed by the pup. From the View, The World, Making It Worse, by Gavin Yamey. See anybody else reporting? No, but Yamey is a physician and professor of global health and public policy at Duke University, where he directs the Center for Policy Impact in Global Health. And Yamey is spelled Y-A-M-E-Y. On his first day back in office, President Trump ordered a 90-day freeze on almost all U.S. foreign aid. Funding stopped for programs that prevent and treat a range of deadly infectious diseases, including HIV, malaria, Marburg virus, mpox, and tuberculosis. In Zambia, distribution of life-saving medical supplies to treat childhood diarrhea and bleeding in pregnant women came to a halt. At one U.S.-funded hospital in the May La refugee camp on the Thai-Myanmar border, 60 patients were sent home. Distressing reports of people being denied their HIV medicines led Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who oversees USAID, to issue an emergency temporary waiver that, in theory at least, allowed U.S. funds to be used to pay for HIV antiretroviral medications under the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, a highly successful program launched by George W. Bush that saved more than 25 million lives. But the Department of State later said the waiver covers HIV treatment and services for preventing transmission of HIV from mother to children, but not other kinds of preventive services. If the goal of all the stop work orders is to end dependence on U.S. aid, they will instead aggravate the need for it. There's now a wealth of evidence and real-world experience on how low- and middle-income countries can best transition out of aid and take over the funding of their disease control programs in a way that is careful, safe, well-planned, and unhurried. The process typically takes around a decade or more, during which countries spend an increasing amount of their own resources on these programs, year on year, so they don't face a sudden spending cliff when the donor exits. Managing donor exits well is critical in order to maintain the remarkable gains that have been made by countries with the support of aid donors in controlling deadly infectious diseases over the past few decades. These gains are fragile in places where there's still ongoing transmission of an infectious disease. Disease control programs must be maintained and never interrupted. Transition is done slowly and carefully because countries need adequate time to get their health delivery systems and their finances strong enough to fully assume control of these programs. Sudden, chaotic withdrawal of aid is the worst kind of interruption, one that puts lives on the line. To see what happens when aid donors withdraw their support precipitously, we need only look at what happened in Romania. In 2010, the Global Fund for AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, the world's largest multilateral donor to HIV programs, rapidly departed, with no plan put in place for the Romanian government to fund or take over HIV prevention services. The exit was compounded by the simultaneous withdrawal of funding from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, an aid donor that had supported HIV prevention efforts among people who inject drugs. The double whammy was catastrophic. Among people who inject drugs, HIV prevalence rose from 1.1% in 2009 to 6.9% 3 years later. By 2013, 53% of the population had HIV. We can also look to see what happens when funding for malaria control programs is halted in places where there's still ongoing transmission. In a study we published in 2012, we found 75 resurgence events in 61 countries from the 1930s through the 2000s. Almost all of the resurgence events, 68 out of the 75, were due at least in part to weakening of the malaria control program. The most common reason for this weakening was a disruption in funding. The message is clear. Trump's sudden disruption of funding to disease control programs worldwide will wreak havoc. When people stop taking the HIV medicines, they don't just become sick. Their HIV viral load also rises, which can drive transmission. The New York Times reports that in Uganda, aid workers estimate about 40 newborns contracted HIV per day when the U.S. stopped funding for antiretroviral drugs. Sudden treatment interruptions can also cause the rise of drug-resistant HIV strains. Patients who develop a resistant strain are not able to go back on the same drugs. They will need different, more costly, second-line medicines. Freezing U.S. health aid is the opposite of a well-managed, careful transition out of aid. It puts people at risk of illness and death, and the whole world in danger of disease, raging out of control. There's a photo here in color. The setting appears to be a tent because I see yellow, blue, and white stripes that go into a peak above the heads of the people inside the tent. One woman with a small child on her lap is seated, and others are crowded around her as if they're in a line. They're like holding, the adults are holding both forms, paper forms, and children. And the caption reads, "Mothers with children participating in a World Health Organization malaria vaccine pilot program in Gisambai, Kenya, in March 2023. Health Matters by Angela Haupt, editor, Health and Wellness. This is the View inbox. The flu is always a nasty foe, and it is particularly vicious this year. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, there have been at least 12 million flu infections since the fall in the U.S., leading to 160,000 hospitalizations and 6,600 deaths. Most of these are influenza A, a strain that causes more serious illness than influenza B. If you are getting flu-like symptoms and you're like, this feels worse than before, you are not wrong, says Dr. Mahesh Polavarapu, Medical Director of Emergency Medicine at New York Presbyterian Westchester. It's pretty harsh this year. Fortunately, there are ways to alleviate at least some of the misery of the flu, besides, of course, getting your annual flu shot before you get sick. Doctors often prescribe Tamiflu, an antiviral that can treat both influenza A and B. While most people have flu symptoms for 3 to 7 days, Tamiflu can shorten that by about 24 hours by blocking the virus from replicating in your body. It is basically stopping the virus from multiplying or shedding any more than it already has, Polavarapu says. Tamiflu starts working, that's spelled T-A-M-I-F-L-U. It starts working after the first dose, and within a day or two, it will have built up in your body enough to make a noticeable difference. But timing's crucial. You need to start taking it within 48 hours of symptom onset. I tell patients to consider it a way to reduce the duration of their symptoms by hopefully a day, Polavarapu says. Tamiflu, also sold under the generic name, also Tamivir, can be prescribed as a pill or in liquid form, and most adults take 75 milligrams twice a day for 5 days, he adds. You are most likely to benefit from Tamiflu if you have risk factors that predispose you to serious flu infection. That includes being 65 or older, under 2, pregnant, immunocompromised, or having a chronic condition like diabetes, heart disease, or asthma. Research suggests starting Tamiflu within 2 days of developing symptoms can reduce the risk of death from a serious case of the flu. It also lowers ICU admission rates among hospitalized adults. Is it really worth it just to feel better 1 day sooner? Flu makes you feel very crummy, so a day less is certainly better than a day more, says Dr. Helen Chu, a professor of medicine, allergy, and infectious diseases at the University of Washington. But it is not like a dramatic difference, so I understand why people have reservations about it. Whether it's right for you comes down to your own priorities. You have to weigh your pros and cons, she says. You have to go pick up the medicine, and it can make people nauseated. Yet there's another often significant benefit to keep in mind. It can be a way to help keep your family members safe. While you can still spread the flu to other people while you're on the antiviral, research suggests Tamiflu helps prevent household outbreaks. In one study, it reduced secondary infections among people who lived in the same house by 50% if those who were not sick yet started Tamiflu within 24 hours. Unfortunately, you cannot just pop Tamiflu if you're merely trying to dodge the illness. Your doctor will not prescribe it unless you have a close exposure. It is not like a vitamin you might take in hopes of bolstering immune health. It is not a preventive measure, Polavarapu says. However, if you've been exposed to the flu, especially by someone in your household, many doctors will consider prescribing a prophylactic dose to lower your chance of infection. Tamiflu is a safe medication, Polavarapu says. Still, as with all medications, there's a risk of side effects. You might feel nauseated and even vomit if you take Tamiflu. Sometimes, if a patient does not tolerate it well, he prescribes anti-nausea medication alongside it. Medications like antivirals are not always the answer, Polavarapu says. They are an answer in a specific time duration and for certain people, but they are not a magic flu-dissipating bullet, and whether they are right for you depends on your unique circumstances. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, the Italian Trump Whisperer. There's a photo. It's inset in the center of this one-page article. It features probably 5 people in a small crowd. I see one woman, one man. The rest are indescribable in terms of gender, but I can tell you one thing. They're all wearing dark blue suits. Maloney, who is the blonde woman in the center of the photograph, and where we see only other people's heads, in fact, the backs of their heads, with Argentina's President Javier Milei at Trump's inauguration in January. Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni's political fortunes are far brighter than any other G7 leaders. Her Brothers of Italy party is polling at 30% support, high in a multi-party system, and neither her coalition partners nor the opposition are in a position to challenge her. While incumbents across much of the world keep getting the boot, and other European leaders are struggling, with French President Emmanuel Macron weakened and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz on his way out this month, Meloni's leadership remains undisputed. Against this backdrop, Donald Trump's return to the White House presents both a challenge and an opportunity for Meloni, and that's spelled M-E-L-O-N-I. The U.S. president has threatened to levy massive tariffs on the EU, reconsider the U.S. commitment to NATO and the Transatlantic Alliance, force an unfavorable ceasefire deal on Ukraine. His transactional unilateralist approach to foreign policy and open support for Eurosceptic leaders pose a test for European cohesion at a time when the continent faces major challenges. Yet even as most of Meloni's European peers are bracing for disruption, she is uniquely placed to have good relations with the new administration. Having come to power as a nationalist firebrand, Meloni not only shares an ideological affinity with the MAGA movement, but she also has a warm rapport with Trump and is close with his advisor-in-chief, Elon Musk. It's no surprise that she was the only EU and G7 leader to attend Trump's inauguration and the third EU leader to meet him before his return to office. But Meloni is no Viktor Orban, the most outspoken EU critic and Trump advocate in the bloc. Despite her far-right Eurosceptic roots, the Italian leader has tacked drastically toward the political center since becoming prime minister in 2022, towing the EU line on Ukraine, abiding by EU fiscal rules, maintaining constructive relations with the European Commission. She's much closer to Commission President Ursula von der Leyen than to Trump and Musk. Given Italy's economic dependence on the EU, this is likely to continue. Meloni will be careful to stay in Trump's good graces by playing up policies that align with his agenda. She will vocally push back on parts of the EU green agenda, which she says could hurt Italian households and businesses, and ramp up efforts to curb migration. She will also pay lip service to Trump's attempts to bring about a ceasefire in Ukraine, even as she remains fundamentally hawkish. Meloni will use the goodwill she earns with Washington to try to advance Italian interests and limit the fallout from Trump's policies. This could include negotiating carve-outs for U.S. tariffs on EU goods and getting a pass on Italy's lagging defense spending. But she will also try to use her unique position as Trump whisperer to advocate for Europe more broadly, especially on Ukraine, thereby acting as a force multiplier for Brussels, Berlin, and Paris. Yet this balancing act will become harder to sustain as U.S.-EU relations sour. Italy's defense spending is around 1.5% of GDP, and Rome will struggle to meet the 2% NATO target, let alone Trump's new demands for 5%. This is likely to become a point of contention. Italy's economic exposure will further complicate her position. The country is the EU's second largest exporter to the U.S., behind Germany, and runs a massive trade surplus with Washington, more than $25 billion in 2023. A trade war and rising U.S. interest rates would undermine Italy's already lackluster GDP growth and put pressure on public debt, making Rome even more reliant on the EU to keep economic risks in check than it already is. These vulnerabilities will put Meloni's dexterity to the test. While she will walk this tightrope as long as she can, she will surely stick with Europe if push comes to shove, rather than jump to Trump. Back to the Paw Patrol with one full-page color photograph. It shows a little boy sitting like on a window ledge or window seat. There are windows behind him, and they are open because one needs to see the Paw Patrol aircraft flying in the background, well, really being held by someone's hands in the background. A blue and a red helicopter-looking type thing. Oh, two things, one blue and one red. Okay, so the little guy's sitting on his knees, kneeling on his knees. He's got bright orange pants and a dark blue hoodie. And he's got very dark hair, and we don't see his eyes, but his eyes are looking downward while he's smiling at all of the toys amassed around him. Very small figures, the figures of the little dogs that were seen previously in a photo where they were giant, larger than the child next to them. Then there are little dog-like things that I imagine are mobile in some way. And there are more vehicles, none of which looks exactly like a fire truck or police car, but they're populated by these little characters, these little dog characters. Then there's, this may be the lookout tower that was referred to in that article. It's about two stories high. It looks like an airport control tower, and it's got a spiraling slide, not a staircase, but a slide, and it's got a big indentation of a paw print on the side, and it's got some kind of a light. I don't know if it's really working or not at the top. And on the top level, the top tier, there's a dog standing watch in a circular gallery area, and there's a red roof on it. And then there's the slide, and then at the bottom, it looks like there's a ladder. This would be on the first story going up to the second story. So we've got this slide, a circular slide. We've got a ladder, and it looks like there's even a pole. So perhaps somewhere inside this, there's a tubular thing in this gallery. Probably inside that, there's this fireman's pole, a blue pole. Then there's a TV set. Now, I don't know if that's part of the workings, or if it's a real TV set. Now, we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, and I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.